providing unique reporting on markets and companies since 1990. This is the Cortland Economics Report.
All right, welcome back here to wrap up the weekend edition of the KE Report. We are chatting with Chris Ritchie, president of Silvercrest Metals. Silvercrest Metals is traded on the TSX under the symbol SIL and on the NYSE under the symbol SILV. Now, we're not going to be getting too much of an update here on Silvercrest, except more at the end of this interview, talking about some of the catalysts that Chris sees for the company. But I more want to talk about the general sector here. And Chris, you are at the BMO conference this week. This is a conference where a lot of the high-quality companies get invited to the conference, and there are a lot of big money banks there, a lot of big money investors. I find it's a good avenue and a good time to get an understanding of what the mood is for these banks, for some of the larger investors that could be in the sector, but also sometimes are just watching the sector from the sideline. Broad question to start here, Chris, is what is the general mood at BMO, and what are some of the major themes that have caught your eye?
Yeah, thanks. A lot of really interesting things going on there. One is that costs are going up. Agnico came out and they had a pretty significant cost increases across the board, nearing in the round of 20%. The multiples of the industry are still ridiculously cheap relative to other sectors. And one of the most interesting things I read was the Glencore presentation, where the new CEO kind of got up and really highlighted this and saying all these EV companies, turbine companies, energy transition companies are trading at multiples that are just dramatically higher than where the commodity companies are, but they use all the commodities. And there's starting to be a little bit of pushback on, we aren't going to grow unless we're rewarded for that growth, meaning a lot of these companies are trading at below replacement cost. So the cost to go find a new asset and getting up and running is higher than where the commodity prices are today. So a lot of them are just sort of saying, hey, we need to be rewarded for that growth, so we're not necessarily going to make those investments.
Well, Chris, just speaking of replacement costs in the industry, that is an interesting idea. We had talked a little bit off mic before we started recording about just what it takes mining companies, whether it's gold, silver, copper, to replace the ounces in the ground, not just on their AISC, but really from more of an expanded long-term picture. Would you mind walking people through what the reality is for mining companies and where the industry needs to get?
Sure. I can speak to silver, more closely than others, but I'm sure it's a theme that cuts across the commodity base. But you know, we did the exercise at Silvercrest to look at, you know, every single penny we've spent since day one, all the way through to the closure of the mine, including some cost inflation every year. And we're in the neighborhood of about $14 an ounce. You know, again, that's very different than our operating cost per ounce. And the reason it's a relevant number is, you know, today at $25 silver, for us, that's a lot of margin. No problem, you know, if we can replace that. But the idea of growth means, okay, well, what's the average project, right? If I'm going to go sell my ounces at $25, what am I going to do with those dollars? And do I have enough opportunities in front of me to go get back more ounces cheaper than $25 an ounce? So our all-in sustaining cost in our feasibility study was sub $7. So even if that number trickles higher, and let's just say roughly $8, the industry average, and this is as per, you know, BMO or Scotia or RBC price deck for the senior producers, is over $18. So that means that's about $10 higher for our roughly $14 replacement cost, assuming an average project. So now your hurdle rate is about $24. Well, that doesn't include your exploration. Okay. So again, who knows if you're going to spend money and not find ounces, or the project actually gets you anywhere. It's a tricky number to get, but I wouldn't think it was surprising to have a replacement cost per ounce that could be $5 to $10. So even if you want to use the lower end of that range and you use five, well, now you're getting in the high 20s. What that doesn't include is, well, it's going to take you 10 plus years to get a new project with permitting and all those other challenges in there. Well, what's the cost inflation between now and then? And what's the impact to their operating costs? So you got to price that in. What's the G&A and your overhead? What's tax risk? What's execution risk, right? So when you start to add it all up, you get a pretty clear picture for silver that the average project to go get something new up and running is higher than where silver is today. So as companies start to get cleaner balance sheets, and this is definitely the case for oil. So what we're seeing right now in the energy space is, for the first time in a long time, these companies are really healthy. They have strong free cash flow. They have strong balance sheets. And what that basically means is they have choices. You know, and when you're choking on debt and you're barely paying bills, you have to sell your commodity no matter what. You're a price taker. But now these people can show some discipline. And, you know, if logic prevails, that means people are going to be a lot more careful how they allocate capital if the growth opportunities aren't there. So again, it's going to be very interesting across all commodities to see if this means we're not going to grow until we're properly rewarded, either via the multiples or in selling your commodity at a higher price than what it costs to replace it. So we'll see. The industry hasn't been overly disciplined in the past, but again, investors have been pushing back for a long time to be disciplined. So if this is the case, there could be a big shortage coming in a market that needs even more of these commodities going forward to make this green energy transition that everyone's pushing for.
So, Chris, big picture, are you saying here that the mining companies could, in a way, almost band together here and say, we're not going to keep producing these metals simply because you guys aren't buying our shares? You're not giving us the value for it, and everything's getting more expensive. So, quite frankly, we're going to take control of the narrative, we being the mining companies, and in a way completely disrupt supply?
Well, right now, you know, the world has a time span that is about as long as a tweet, and it takes about 20 years to bring a new mine online. So if you're sitting on big growth projects and you've got the expertise and the balance sheets while still having big, robust production profiles, the best thing you can do is just to produce and you know, do the right things by your money. Maybe that means buying back your stock with your capital as opposed to building projects, you know, increasing your dividends. So it's not about collusion or anything like that. It's just more saying we now have the flexibility to behave appropriately. And until you're rewarded for growth, it doesn't make sense to grow. And again, this is really where the big picture, long-term stuff really makes sense. Because again, North America, we're very short-term focused, you know, but yet we're dealing in a world right now with countries like China and whatnot that are dealing very long-term focused. And I think that sort of speaks to some of the geopolitical challenges we're having here, where commodities themselves are turning into currencies. And obviously we're seeing massive inflation with COVID and whatnot. So the world revolves around these commodity prices.
Well, Chris, on that point about commodities being the new currencies, even some of the sanctions that have been put on Russia have only helped the currencies that they export, whether it be oil and natural gas or palladium and nickel or the wheat and the grains and the soft commodities. And if they're removed from the SWIFT banking system and kind of isolated, they could easily start teaming up with China. That's another commodity powerhouse. And it could be that the East has a stranglehold on commodities even more so than they do now if Western companies are not compensated. So how do you think that all flushes out?
I think in the early days of this invasion into Ukraine, you know, you hear some people saying, oh, the West should go in and fight back. I think we need to be careful to understand if we go in and Russia is on its knees and Putin's on his last days, he still has access to nuclear weapons. So I think you have to look at the end game to realize that in today's day and age, any war can end really badly with superpowers. So the types of wars we're going to be fighting are hopefully anything but wars, you know, with military forces. And if that's the case, these commodities become the currency. And it's no surprise that, you know, prior to this invasion, that Russia had enough gold that equaled 80% of the rubles. Well, the ruble just got crushed and gold just went way up. So they had been years for years and years and years getting this hedge, right? 39 or 40% of their GDP is oil. Yes, that's cut off, but you know, I wouldn't be surprised if there's other countries around the world buying their oil. You know, the nat gas leverage they have over Europe. So these commodities are becoming currencies. And, you know, with these sanctions and whatnot, it's just driving up prices left, right, and center. And one of the crazy things was right before Thanksgiving this year, the U.S. government actually released strategic petroleum reserves to try to drop oil prices before driving season and Thanksgiving. you know, and if that's the sort of way the West is thinking in terms of extremely short-term gratification and political expediency relative to countries looking up to tie up resources for strategic reasons, these commodities are becoming more and more important. It only reinforces that concept of the replacement cost and the true value of these resources. Again, all while these companies are trading at extreme lows right now while being really healthy. So if these CEOs are starting to realize, hey, we've got a lot of leverage with these big resources, and we're not rewarded appropriately for growing right now, there's a really big dynamic here that just speaks to, you know, the valuation and the value in the space.
So then, Chris, who do you see coming in as buyers? Because you have laid out, I think, a very logical, I guess, balance of what we are seeing within the sector here and the mostly unloved nature that investors have taken towards mining companies. Are the big banks interested in either starting to buy up some sort of commodities themselves or actually putting their money behind mining companies, saying that, look, we do need these assets, and quite frankly, resource prices have gone up, so companies are stronger balance sheet-wise, really across the board, especially cash flow-wise?
Yeah, I think there's a few different players out there. I mean, if you're big governments around the world looking to buy up big strategic deposits of things that are nowhere near coming to cash flow and just sitting on them, I mean, I think some of these strategic buyers, you know, you might be producing some of these commodities, but they might never hit the market. They might just go into warehouses for these countries behind these things. So like supply and demand challenges. And the reality in the market, you know, mining is a tiny, tiny percentage. I think it's less than 1 or 2% in the broad U.S. indices. So the general market just doesn't care. And that's just the nature of where things are. So there's no new money. There's no new fund flow. You know, if you look at some of the momentum and quant fund behavior, we had a call with a brokerage fund last week that said, like, yeah, sure, short-term momentum is starting to pick up for the gold and silver space. It's kind of middle of the pack, but long-term momentum is still near the basement levels. So we really haven't seen the long-term momentum pick up to sort of wake up some of that institutional money or quant funds and retail. Like, they're nowhere near this space. I mean, we're still at lower silver levels we were than the Wall Street silver sort of rush a year ago. And basically, no retail. I mean, this came off one of the worst years in a long time for the gold and silver space, when it was the second worst performing sector in the Canadian market. A huge tax loss selling. And this is just low volume, you know, gapping up on some of the macro and geopolitical stuff. So I don't think we've seen real buying yet, which kind of bodes well, because as everyone knows, for cyclical businesses, these higher commodity prices are actually making the stocks cheaper, right? So they're going up and the valuations aren't, right? You know, you go up a little bit, but again, the price increases are making these things stay extremely cheap.
Well, Chris, just along those lines, with these inflationary pressures hitting a lot of companies, but also with metals prices staying buoyed and actually heading higher, which does help with the margin expansion, how is SilverCrest set up, and what are the main takeaways you want people to know from the SilverCrest balance sheet, from the growth profile, and really the direction moving forward for 2022?
Yeah, we've always been really big on promoting our defense and our balance sheet and our margins and the quality of the asset, because if you get crazy volatility, you know, you want to show resilience across the ups and the downs. We've always referred to, you know, $19 silver and $1,500 gold, giving us $160 million of project level free cash flow in 2023. But if you look at our feasibility study numbers at $1,950 gold and $27 and change silver, that project level free cash flow, and that's an after-tax number, but it's again before G&A and exploration and whatnot, that number is over $200 million for next year. So, you know, if you look at the market cap today and you look at sort of the free cash flow profile, you're getting something, you know, in and around sort of the 9 to 12, 13% free cash flow yield in your year one, you know. So this is something where, again, the cash balances are going to grow really quickly with these companies quickly. So again, from a risk perspective, we're very happy that we're nearing the end of construction, which is usually no man's land. You know, we're going to have, you know, somewhere between, you know, 40 and 60 million of additional capital after the construction's over. And the amount of debt we have is about $90 million. So that free cash flow number, it's not only is the excess cash mostly going to pay that down, you know, the free cash flow alone would be paying that off in 2 or 3 quarters. So our timing is fantastic in terms of coming to the end of construction. We should be sort of ramping up the plant and whatnot in Q2 this year, right? So I think the timing is quite interesting. Again, after us being sort of in the depths of no man's land, with everybody being so afraid of these cost increases. So again, for people that are getting out of the way and whatnot, we're hopefully going to hit the mark, our cash flow, right at the right time.
So Chris, let's talk a little bit more about the Silvercrest share price and some of the potential buyers that could come into the stock, because I think we all agree that there isn't a whole lot of new money coming into the sector, or any new money, even with some of these better financial metrics, everything, the better fundamentals that we're seeing within these companies. The Silvercrest share price has bounced nicely from a low in October on the Toronto Exchange of a little over $8. Now the share price right around $12. So it has benefited, but that's still off of the highs of over $16 at the beginning of 2021. As the company moves forward closer to production, who are some of the new buyers that could come into the stock and provide that catalyst to keep moving the stock higher?
Sure. Well, one, retail hasn't been there. They were beat up pretty badly last year. So I think that's someone, that's a sector that's just really ripe for a lot of new buying. Our short interest actually went up near the end of last year. And we talked about that in the last call. So, I mean, there's probably a fairly significant short cover that is potentially out there. And the last update I got, that the short interest was not even down at all, even despite this recent move. You know, once you get into production, if you're over 750 million US market cap and you trade more than $1 million a day in liquidity, and we're averaging about 20, you become eligible for the GDX. And that's a big ETF, and that ETF has to go out and buy a bunch of shares. I don't have the math, and we're potentially eligible in the back half of this year, but it's not a slam dunk. But there's potential pretty significant buying that would occur from that. And there's also a lot of big funds that are in the mining space that don't like companies that aren't producing. So at the end of the day, you can sort of say that these big funds can say, hey, we're in the mining space, but, you know, we can't touch you until you kind of get through that construction phase. So, you know, there's a lot of people that could look at this. And not to even mention, if you go back to Q4 2020, Q1 2021, a little bit of Q2 2021, we traded approximately $2.9 billion above the $9 US share price level. And the reason I referenced those particular three quarters is that was prior to our feasibility study coming out, it was prior to our financing, it was right at the front of construction, right when everybody is, hey, get me out of here, I don't like the risk profile. You know, but that's in and around today's share price. So if you can look at it now, gold price is up, we're right near the end of construction, our balance sheet is strong. You can almost get back in at the same price as people sold with a completely different risk-reward dynamic. So even if you have a small percentage of that $2.9 billion of stock traded above those levels come back, that would tighten up the supply and demand of the stock itself. I know the people that love this space tend to look at some of the small stuff, but if you really think of a global perspective, we're a tiny company. So again, you know, 100, 200, 300 million of demand coming from the shareholders that appreciated the early run-up, got out before the big risk. You know, again, if they just come back a little bit, it can have a really big impact.
Well, Chris, we're going to wrap it up here. And you bring up some very good points and some good, I guess, strategy in a way of how the mining sector could start to take control of their own narrative. I really haven't heard this argument before, but it does make sense as these companies are better positioned from a cash perspective and from a balance sheet perspective, which is much, much different than what we saw last time. Gold especially was at these levels, and silver still broadly lagging gold. But overall, thank you for the update. Thank you for the insights into the BMO conference. If anybody has any follow-up questions on the silver market or even Silvercrest, as always, you can email us, fleck@kereport.com and chad@kereport.com. Full disclosure, Chad is a shareholder of Silvercrest Metals. And hey, everybody, Chris included, thank you for taking time with us on this weekend show. We'll be back full time next week covering these wild markets and hopefully some more positive moves in some of these metals and commodities and the underlying stock. Everyone, thank you for tuning in this weekend, and I hope you all have a great rest of your weekend.